This is the third day of this October 2016 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday and the day before, a book called Zen Dawn, which is a collection of early Zen texts from the Dunhuang Caves. These texts are dated back to the 8th century anyway. And these are translated by J.C. Cleary. I wish I could convey to the listeners the feeling I get when reading these, just from having been to the Dunhuang Caves long ago now, some 30 years ago. It was on one of my two pilgrimages through China, and it remains the sort of the high point for me because it had such a pure, simple quality to it. These caves, they hadn't been developed and made into tourist sites by the Chinese government. The temples that we visited had been kind of appropriated by the Chinese government, and they were making money off them. But these caves, it's like they're just out there in the desert. There's almost nobody there. And in reading these, this material, keep returning to that kind of the primitiveness of that desert oasis, and the awareness that these very texts had sat there for what, 1100 years, 1200 years, protected by the exceedingly dry and climate, these great sutras and other records. And there's a simplicity to the language also, fewer complex sentences than in texts that we read from in later meaning, like, you know, the 10th century or the 12th century. We left off yesterday from the section on Bodhidharma, and he had said that there are basically two paths, two ways of entering, two roads for entering the path. One is entering through, let's just say, realization, to keep it simple, and the other is through these four practices. The first of which is being aware of the causes and the fact that whatever kind of misfortune we suffer, it is not by accident. There is a previous cause to it. That's the first. The second was adapting to. The wisdom of adapting to or concurring with the ups and downs of life. And now the third, this is where we left off, the practice of not seeking anything. He says, worldly people are always deluded, craving everything, becoming attached everywhere. This is called seeking. The wise awaken to the real. Using inner truth, they reach the conventional world. Pacifying mind without contrived activity, changing shape as they go, the myriad states of being are thereby emptied. The myriad states of being are thereby emptied. By pacifying mind without contrived activity. again, my mind goes to Sesshin, the work of Sesshin, where we are slicing through one mind state after another, one makyo after another, different kinds of emotional states. And in doing so, we are emptying the mind of these different phenomena. Along with this, the darkness of meritorious deeds, and that phrase is in quotation marks, the darkness of meritorious deeds is forever banished. I'm going to now refer to this other translation from the Golden Age of Zen. I think it's a little better, at least with that leading up to that sentence, John Wu says, they adjust their movements to the vicissitudes of fortune, always aware of the emptiness of the phenomenal world in which they find nothing to desire, nothing to delight in. Merit and demerit are ever interpenetrated like light and darkness. Most of you know that there is this strong understanding in China, maybe even more than Japan, of the merit that our deeds can bring to us, our good deeds, and demerit would be sort of the bad karma from violating precepts. And unfortunately, it seems that a lot of Chinese Buddhists get caught between these two poles of merit and demerit. Their principal motivation in supporting the monks and supporting the temples is to get merit. Out of fear of losing merit. But here, Bodhidharma won't have this. He says, merit and demerit are ever interpenetrated like light and darkness. So long as we're thinking about getting something out of our behavior, out of our conduct, then it can't be pure. I'm sticking with the John Woo translation here for a moment. He goes, to stay too long in the triple world is to live in a house on fire. Everyone who has a body is an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. This point is driven home to us in Sesshin. We may be able to avoid suffering or certain kinds of suffering a lot in our daily lives. But then our pain becomes so simple and basic in Sesshin. It's physical pain or pain of possibly boredom, of emotional states that we can get into and we can't get away from because we're sitting. We need to sit through them. Pain of remorse for things we've done or said to people. That's the simple physical pain of having a body. This is a famous statement of Bodhidharma. Everyone who has a body is an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. Having comprehended this point, the wise are detached from all things of the phenomenal world, with their minds free of desires and craving. And as the sutra has it, all sufferings spring from attachment. true joy arises from detachment. And then Bodhidharma says, to know clearly the bliss of detachment is truly to walk on the path of the Tao. This is the rule of non-attachment. I think a lot of people can get really hung up on this word attachment and the idea of it and kind of the daunting challenge of living in the world as a householder, as a layperson, without dwelling in attachment or building up attachments. I think it's important to accept one's path as a householder, as someone, a married person, or someone involved in relationships, and recognize that for sure that will develop attachments. We become attached to our loved one, just as we became attached to our parents when we were children, and attached to our dogs and cats. We become attached to people we love or friends of. All right. It would be just silly to not make peace with that and recognize that if you're not a monk or a non-living in a monastery, then you need to form attachments. But then, can we be aware of other things to which we're becoming attached that we don't really need to be attached to? All of the many forms of addictive behavior that we all know about so well. Shopping and the internet and everything on the internet, the many unwholesome things that we can get into in the internet. Fill in the blank. And then it doesn't help to be framing it in terms of right and wrong or good or bad, to sit every day, is a way of snipping these roots of attachment that are over and beyond what living in the world and relationships involve. Too many people make an all or nothing thing out of this. Why do we want to minimize our attachments? Because attachments breed suffering. We become attached to people, to things, and it is only a matter of time before we lose them. There's always loss in the future, and to the degree that we're attached, to that degree we will suffer. Doesn't mean attachments are bad. It just means that we set ourselves up for pain with every attachment we acquire. Just to be conscious of the other side of attachments. There's a wonderful thing about attachments. I always say that it's just a normal part of child development to develop attachment to parents or siblings, especially parents. All right. That's no child has much choice in that. No child has the ability to decline to be attached to their parents. But there are so many, as adults, there are so many things that we can recognize as potentially painful eventually because of our attachments to them. Back to the other, our main text, then dawn here. Listen to the difference of the translation. Some of what I just read from the Golden Age of Zen here in Zen Dawn: dwell for long in the triple world, it is like a house on fire. All who have bodies suffer, who can find peace? When this is completely comprehended, thoughts of the various states of being cease and there is no seeking. The sutra says, all who seek suffer. If there is no seeking, only then is there bliss. Thus we know that not seeking anything is truly a practice of the path. But aren't we all seeking something? Just in coming to practice and coming to sesshin, isn't this seeking? Well, it doesn't need to be. It is, yes, maybe this is a matter of semantics, but I prefer the word aspiration. We come to sesshin, we come to practice aspiring to realize who we are, aspiring to develop ourselves. The problem comes when this aspiration becomes a grasping at something that we want to get for ourselves. That's, I think, what Bodhidharma is talking about. Bodhidharma himself sat, we're told, day and night facing a wall. And the further we go in practice, the more likely we're going to be able to sit without grasping, but sit for its own sake. Do zazen without a goal in mind, without even a purpose, but just for its own sake. No one, and I know Bodhidharma would say this, no one would ever say anyone has to apologize for working hard in practice, for being never satisfied with whatever level we find ourselves at. The texts are full of these masters who, even after awakening, were still not satisfied and sat to further purify the mind, clarify the understanding. And then the fourth practice says here, the practice of according with the Dharma. The Dharma, the teaching of reality, is based on the inner truth of the inherent purity of all things. By this inner truth, the multitude of forms are all empty. There is no defilement, no attachment, no this, no that. The sutra says, again, I think he's probably quoting the Lankavatara Sutra, the Dharma has no sentient beings because it is detached from the impurity of sentient beings. The Dharma has no self because it is detached from the impurity of self. The John Woo translation, instead of impurity, has stain. The Dharma has no sentient beings because it is detached from the stain of sentient beings. And the same with the self, the stain of the self. What does this mean, the stain of the self? the impurity of the self. It means this basic self-centeredness. What has been called this root narcissism that we all have to some degree until true enlightenment. The wonderful author Houston Smith, in the book he co-authored called Buddhism, used a nifty analogy. He said, "This root narcissism, or whatever he called it, is if you think you're free of it," he says, "watch when you look at a group photo that you're in. Who do you look at first? Who in that photo do you look at first?" Bodhidharma continues, "If the wise can believe and understand with certainty this inner truth, they ought to practice in accord with the Dharma." I'm going to switch to the other translation. "When the wise are convinced of this truth, they should live in harmony with the Dharma." John Wu continues, "As there is no shadow of holding back in the whole body of the Dharma, so the wise are ever ready to put their body, life, and property at the service of giving." That's the dana, "never ceasing to be generous and gracious. Having thoroughly pierced through the threefold nature of emptiness, they are no longer dependent upon or attached to anything. Even in their work of helping all living beings, their sole motive is to cleanse them of their stains. And while they are among them, as of them, they take care not to be contaminated by a possessive love. In this way, they manage to keep themselves perfect and at the same time to benefit others. Besides, they glorify the true Tao of enlightenment. As with the virtue of giving or dana, so with the other five of the paramitas. The wise practice the six virtues of perfection in order to sweep away all confused thoughts, but they feel as though they were doing nothing to speak of. This is indeed acting in accord with the Dharma." Well, in other words, acting selflessly. And of course, he's talking here about an extremely exalted state. And then back to Zendon. By the way, these are referred to the records of the Lanka. And then it says the great teacher Bodhidharma would point to things and ask their meaning. He would just point to something. What is it? "There is a multitude of things. Question them all. Interchange their names, and with them changed, question them." Interchange their names. So that's one of the most basic of all attachments, is our attachment to words. And the words that someone rather arbitrarily assigned to nouns and other things. Through our this convention of language, of this word meaning referring to this, and then this word meaning that, we become attached to the thingness of things, not realizing that every word is just a substitute for our true nature. Everything is the same self nature, but because of all the differentiation of words, we come to believe that things are fragmented. We lose the awareness of the underlying unity that is behind all these words. So we refer to this as a stick. Let's call it a pot. Okay, now what is it? Let's call it a wrench. What is it? Its nature, its true nature is not in the words. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record in which Unmon says, "Pick up the temple gate and place it on the lamp." How would you do that? He also said, "Does this body exist or not? What body is this body?" This question, does the body exist or not, is not a silly question. Yes, we know the sense in which it does exist. If we stub our toe, it's pretty clear that in that sense it exists. But what exists? What is feeling the pain? Who is feeling the pain? The body is not a static thing. It's energy in a certain congealed form that is changing continuously. As soon as we talk about the body, it's already changed. So what kind of thing is there that we can even talk about? He also said, "The clouds in the sky can never stain the empty sky, but they can cover over the sky so that it is not bright and clear." Well, we know what he's talking about there by analogy. Now the next chapter, which is about Bodhidharma's successor, Wei Ke. The one who took it up after the Chan master Bodhidharma was the Chan master Wei Ke. At the age of 14, he met Bodhidharma, who was traveling and teaching in the region. Wei Ke served him for 6 years, investigating the one vehicle with pure energy and drawing near to the inner truth. Wei Ke gave an outline account of cultivating the path and of the essential method for illuminating mind, whereby one truly reaches the fruit of enlightenment. The Lankavatara Sutra says, Shakyamuni contemplated in stillness and thus left birth and death far behind. This is called not grasping. And then it continues, of all the enlightened ones of the 10 directions, past and present, there is not one who became Buddha without a basis in sitting meditation. We know their stories, some very rare stories of people who came to awakening spontaneously, but here, without sitting, but here, surely what the author is referring to is true deep enlightenment. And then it says, the text says, the Ten Stages Sutra, there's so many sutras that are referred to in these books I've not only not read but haven't even heard of. The Ten Stages Sutra says, within the bodies of sentient beings there is an indestructible enlightened nature. It is like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright, round, and full. Its light, vast and boundless. Because it is covered over by the layered clouds of the five skandhas, sentient beings do not see it. Sentient beings always means the unenlightened. If you encounter the wind of wisdom, it blows away the five skandhas. When the layers of clouds are totally gone, the enlightened nature is shining perfectly bright, clear, and pure. This description is like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright, round, and full, vast, and boundless. And yet we hear in the Mumonkan, Mumon say, you describe it in vain, you picture it to no avail. So every description, this and every other description, is inadequate. It gives us a sense of this great luminous mind, but nothing in words can encompass it. The five skandhas, of course, are the five constituents of individual existence: form, that is our bodies, sensation, perception, our mental, our karmic tendencies or mental formations, and consciousness itself. And he quotes the Hua Yan Sutra. It is as vast as the universe, as ultimate as the void. But it is also like a light in a jar that cannot illuminate the outside. Another simile is this. When clouds close in on all sides and the world is darkened, how can the sunlight be bright and clear? The sunlight has not been destroyed. It is just covered over and blocked off by the clouds. The pure, true nature of sentient beings is also like this. It cannot become fully manifest precisely because layers upon layers of clouds cover over and block off the path of the sages. And here by clouds it says afflictions, the perceptions of false thoughts clinging to objects. If false thoughts are not born and you sit in silent purity, the sun of great nirvana is spontaneously bright and clear. Next it says, a worldly book says. A worldly book often refers to a Confucian text, but we don't know what this is. A worldly book says, ice is born from water, but ice can block water. Ice is solid, whereas water flows. This may be the origin of the lines in the Hakuin chant, like water and ice, without water no ice, outside us no Buddhas. It says, similarly, falsity arises from the real, and falsity can lose the real in delusion. When falsity is ended, the real appears. The mind see is clear and pure. The body of reality is empty and clean. These words, these concepts, it can sound so remote, otherworldly, but they point to our own nature, the self nature of every one of us. This is our nature, clear and pure, empty and clean. We're melting this ice block of self and freeing it, restoring it to its original flexibility, fluidity that is our true nature. Therefore, when learners... When learners rely on written and spoken words as the path, these are like a lamp in the wind. They cannot dispel darkness, and their flame dies away. So the limitations of books. But if learners sit in purity without concerns, it is like a lamp in a closed room. It can dispel the darkness, and it illuminates things with clarity. If learners, let's say practitioners, sit in purity without concerns, without thoughts of self, without thoughts of I, me, my practice, progress, regress, better and worse, right and wrong, success and failure. Without all these concerns, we are like a lamp in a closed room. We can dispel the darkness. If you completely comprehend the clear purity of the mind source, then all vows are fulfilled, all practices are completed, all is accomplished. You are no longer subject to states of being. For those who find this body of reality, the numberless sentient beings are just one good person, the one person who has been there in accord with this through a million billion eons. One good person. Linchi, Rinzai, describe this as the person of no rank. Shakyamuni Buddha said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world honored one. This one true self. Continues, if pure energy and true integrity are not generated within you, it accomplishes nothing, even if you encounter countless Buddhas, past, present, and future. Thus we know that sentient beings liberate themselves by knowing mind, the Buddhas do not liberate the sentient beings. If the Buddhas could liberate sentient beings, since we have met countless Buddhas in the past, why haven't we become enlightened? It is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. Unless the mind attains what the mouth speaks of, you will never avoid taking on form according to your deeds. As you never stop endlessly circling through the six worlds, from dark path to dark path, wandering in darkness, unless the mind attains what the mouth speaks of. This statement, it is just what holds us back from realizing this true self. It is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. Integrity is a very rich word in terms of practice. We could say it really refers to oneness, of being fully concentrated on the practice we're working on. If we're not fully concentrated, then there is some division in the mind, some dualism. Integrity means doing it with our whole being, bringing everything we've got to this great matter that is in this simple practice we're doing, not holding back, not doubting, doing it with our whole being. Stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind matter. I bow to the brute dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings of our number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.